Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm just going to start off with a description of the history of tuberculosis in Colorado. Colorado became a state in the late 1800s, and the first state board of health came into existence in March the 22nd of 1877. Some other interesting things about these late 1800s is that it was estimated that a third of the state's residents in 1880 had actually come to Colorado because of either their health or the health of their families. Also in that era, Doc Holliday died of tuberculosis at the sanatorium in Glenwood Springs. So at one point, the Chamber of Commerce actually advertised the health benefits of coming to Colorado for tuberculosis. It was really lauded as sunshine, good fresh air, cold air, high altitude, great place to come, because these were the factors recognized as important in curing tuberculosis. You can see evidence of this even today. These are a couple of pictures from my neighborhood in Montclair. They're what they call TB houses that have what was originally an open porch on both ends of the house. They've since been closed in and air conditioned, as you can imagine. But you can just see remnants of that porch on the south area of that house. Also in Montclair Park, what's called the Mokarai, this was combined as both sanatorium and a dairy to produce milk that was critical to the cure of tuberculosis. The sanatorium movement got started in Colorado in the late 1800s as well. The Albert Glocker Memorial in Colorado Springs in 1890, the Agnes Memorial Sanatorium, Cragmore Sanatorium in Colorado Springs as well. And then in 1899, National Jewish Hospital actually admitted their first patient for tuberculosis. Clearly times have changed, but at that time the motto was, if you could pay, you shouldn't be there, and if you couldn't pay, that's where you should go, basically. On the left you can see a picture of the original building, and on the right the porches where people were getting heliotherapy with sunlight also felt to be a part of the cure of tuberculosis. Clearly, early TB treatment was all based on issues of rest, fresh air, and it didn't matter whether it was winter, summer, or whatever, you were supposed to get fresh air. There's an example here from 1909 of someone chasing the cure out near National Jewish in a tent. Along came pneumothorax or collapse therapy in 1900, attempts to actually close cavities and prevent the spread of tuberculosis. I think there's a number of myths about the effectiveness. Healthcare Colorado has this quote that 60 to 70% of people who came to Colorado actually had improvement in their health. Now, I don't think we expect that those were any sort of randomized or organized studies. And in fact, in 1887, the TB death rate in Colorado was 190 per 100,000. TB was said to affect up to a third of Colorado residents. And just in the period from 1908 to 1920, there were 23,000 recorded deaths, and literally 10,000 of those individuals dying within a year of arrival in Colorado. So may have been helpful, but it was difficult to tell from looking at the statistics. 1940 to 45, the recognition that TB was not only a personal health issue, but also a public health issue. There needed to be restrictions of exposure, and so the idea of quarantine, or really appropriately called isolation, came into existence. And the number of beds in the sanatoriums nationwide went up to almost 98,000 by 1942. Well, what actually happened in the sanatoriums in terms of outcomes? And here's a slide with sort of three examples from Denmark, Great Britain, and the United States, all reporting death rates of 50 to 65% within a 4 to 5 year period. And Stilbo, in his review published in 1978 of untreated patients, said we could expect that two-thirds of untreated patients would be with smear-positive pulmonary tuberculosis would be dead within a 4 to 5 year period. So clearly a very deadly disease that was seemingly unaffected by the sanatorium care. Well, along came the active drugs, and very quickly it became recognized that the effectiveness of these drugs was limited by issues of adherence. And here's a number of studies looking at 40, 50, maybe 65% of patients who were previously treated were really not taking their TB medications. Denver's integrated medical and public health system really got its start under Sam Johnson, and one of the important developments was a grant in 1965 from the CDC that brought not only funds, but John Sabarbro to work in Denver. And he also worked as not only as the director of disease control, but also as the director of the Eastside Neighborhood Health Center. And this was really, I think, the beginnings of the integrated healthcare system at Denver and Denver Health. It involved visiting nurses association, administration, environmental services, social services, and so forth. So this became the community-based comprehensive neighborhood health centers that we're familiar with here in Denver. Now, the history of directly observed therapy really begins with a couple of articles by Fox in the early 60s, and he noted that you could actually have patients come into the clinic and get their injections on a daily basis, and also that it appeared that you could move to an intermittent dosing, which was convenient for the patient as well as for the providers, and still get reasonable outcomes. The rationale for this higher dose intermittent therapy was that the benefit of high-dose drugs would be administered, and yet with maintaining the same weekly dose, perhaps toxicity would be reduced. And I think the bottom point there is one that I think probably John Sabarbro coined, is the concept of chemical quarantine, or really chemical isolation. Instead of putting people in the sanatorium and restricting their activities, if you could get people on directly administered therapy, document that they were actually taking the drugs, that could really replace the restrictions that were used to be used to prevent the spread of tuberculosis. And John published an early report about the effectiveness of twice weekly dosing for the treatment of tuberculosis administered to patients who were quote, unreliable, difficult to treat, and so forth. And then he took it a step further and said, why should we simply try to figure out who is going to be non-adherent or not? Because research has told us over and over that clinicians can identify risk factors for adherence, but they really cannot tell who is going to take their meds or not. And about 60% of us, when we're patients, take our meds, and about the other third of us really have a difficult time accomplishing that, which from a public health perspective can have severe consequences. So here's just a few examples of the follow-up studies that John conducted, and the H refers to INH and the S to streptomycin and E to ethambutol. And so after about 11 weeks of daily treatment with injectable streptomycin, paraminosalicylic acid, or later ethambutol, INH, the patients were moved to twice weekly dosing with either INH and strep or INH and ethambutol or sometime the combination. And as a result of this, really in 1975, directly observed therapy sort of became the standard of care at Denver Public Health. So what really made the program successful? And I think there's several things. One was a detailed history was obtained at the time of diagnosis, which is obviously critical for knowing the patient well and also for follow-up. The other is what we now call case management. A nurse and often an outreach worker were assigned the specific responsibility for making sure that the patient got treated, so the responsibility was could be identified and not diffused through the clinic. In addition, flexibility in treatment, anywhere from the home, the clinic, the shelter, and they even used the emergency department for patients who were working and couldn't get into the clinic during regular work hours. And I think the most important thing is every missed visit was followed up within 24 hours. And if you think about it, there's nothing about the mode of directly observed therapy that will prevent adherence. What it does is it identifies adherence immediately. Rather than finding out after 2 months that the patient's really not responding, you know this day they miss their dose that you have an adherence problem. And if you address it, it will work. If you don't address it, you're sending a mixed message. It's important, but we haven't talked to you in a month, and you're supposed to be in here. Where have you been? That's a very different message to be delivering. The 62-dose, 6-month regimen, often called the Denver regimen, was developed here and published in 1990. Dave Cohn was the lead author on that. Frank Judson, who's here with us, was director of public health at that time as well. And this regimen was also implemented in Fort Worth and Baltimore. This is a slide that Pat Chalk put together, just showing a number of studies and completion rates. And you can see that for patients on non-supervised therapy, on average, about 61% would complete treatment. Modified DOT, which is a mixture of the two, about 79%, just DOT, 86%. And then when you use all sorts of incentives and enablers to get patients to complete treatment, you can get treatment rates, completion rates up to 91%. There are just a couple of slides here showing the outcome of changing to directly observed therapy or using it as an exclusive mode of therapy in Fort Worth, showing a decrease in the relapse rate, shown here, the failure rate during therapy here, relapse with multi-drug-resistant TB. And it turns out that drug-resistant TB is the most expensive component of a TB treatment program. You're going to lose money hand over fist with every one of these. And also a decrease in primary and acquired drug resistance. In Baltimore, a little different look at it, showing that from 81 to 92, the case rate in Baltimore dropped about half, whereas in the other top five cities, they remained high, including the top 20 cities if you take out Baltimore from that mix. So if we got such a great program in Colorado and a great history, why can't we get rid of tuberculosis? So this is the case rate over the last 21 years, and you can see that it's bounced between 1.7 and 3.2 cases for 100,000 population. We're clearly not eliminating TB in Colorado, which is our true goal. So why does this happen? And just like in the 1880s, TB in Colorado is all about immigration. This graph shows the number of cases among the U.S.-born population on the bottom, the foreign-born population on the top, so it's the total number of cases per year. You can see that from 1993, the number of cases in the U.S.-born population has dropped, but it's been overwhelmingly replaced by the cases occurring among our foreign-born residents. So this last year, we were down to a low of 85 cases. 60 of those, or 71%, are in our foreign-born residents. We have cases from 19 different countries. Latin America, largely Mexico, but not exclusively, Asia, Africa, and one from Europe. In the United States, we have U.S.-born population, 25 cases for a rate of 0.6 per 100,000 population compared to 12.3 in our foreign-born population, which only makes up about 12 to 13% of our population. So literally, between the 2000 census and the 1990 census and the 2000 census, we had 150 new residents in the Denver metro area who were born outside the United States. And it's a great cultural experience, but they brought their risk of tuberculosis with them in the form of latent tuberculosis infection. Now here's an individual case of a migrant, a young woman from Nepal who came to the United States to study. She presented to an emergency room with severe abdominal pain. She'd been treated once in the Student Health Service for a urinary tract infection and, quote, had no known exposure to tuberculosis, although she grew up in Nepal, and had never had a skin test done. Her chest x-ray at the time of the original visit was, quote, negative for tuberculosis. Things weren't quite right. The Student Health Service tried to get her in for follow-up. It just didn't happen until she presented shortly before her death with a perforated colon due to tuberculosis, cavitary tuberculosis, as you can see here, with positive sputum smears, and despite a laparotomy as well as intravenous levofloxacin, rifampin, amikacin, and other antibiotics, the young woman died shortly after admission. So this was a coroner's case, so her picture ended up in the news, not anything the health department released, but they asked a question, what type of TB did she die of? Was this multi-drug resistant TB? No, this is regular old garden variety, totally drug susceptible tuberculosis. So we have a young woman who died of a preventable illness and a treatable illness. It certainly increased awareness in the community about tuberculosis in a terrible way. But it points out that TB remains an individual and public health threat in the United States unless controlled on a global scale. Each year in the United States, there are around over 7,000 cases of TB in our foreign-born population. Not a large number globally, but it's far too many for us to be seeing. Just have a few slides here about the national goal for TB elimination, which is defined as achieving a case rate of 1 per million population. The Advisory Council for the Elimination of Tuberculosis proposed this in 1989 to be achieved this year. Well, clearly we're not going to get there. That would be only 300 cases of TB in the entire United States this year, and we're way off target. 10 years ago, the Institute of Medicine published a book and said, this is a laudable goal. We're not going to make it by 2010. Let's shoot for 2035. But to do that, we've got to get a 10% annual decrease in the case rate every year. And that hadn't been happening from 2000 to 2008. The average decline was only 3.8%. So the projected year for elimination is 2107. The disturbing thing is that in the non-Hispanic white population, we could achieve TB elimination in 42 years. And at that point, TB will be exclusively a disease of minorities in the United States. The problems are the five major goals the IOM addressed. One was accelerating decline. We clearly haven't done that. It requires increasing the diagnosis and treatment of latent TB infection because that's where most of our cases in the foreign-born are coming. Development of new tools that Dr. Berman will talk about later. And then I think mobilizing and sustaining public support. You have to look at the budget of the Division of TB Elimination, which was recommended to quadruple by the Institute of Medicine in 2000. Instead, it's gone down by about 40% in inflation. What if we were to achieve a goal of 2035 elimination? We would have 253,000 fewer TB cases, over 15,000 fewer deaths, and $1.3 billion less in TB treatment costs. And I'll just close with this slide. Call to action on the tuberculosis elimination plan for the United States was put together by the Stop TB USA. It's on their Stop TB website and really points out for us to achieve TB elimination, it's going to require a major commitment by policymakers at all level of government, local, state, federal, public sector, medical practitioners, professional societies, community-based organizations, and voluntary organizations. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning and look forward to the other presentations. Thank you.